So it's welcome to the Life Jackets part of Shed Talks episode 22, and it is great to see Simon Woodruff sitting opposite me on the screen. Simon, welcome.
Hello.
And we kick off with the subject of gardening, but you are not a thoroughbred gardener, as I understand.
No, I'm not actually. It's one of those things, you see people going to the football, and I always thought I kind of missed out by not following a football team closely.
Yeah.
And you see a lot of people with a lot of getting a lot of pleasure out of gardening, and I've always had too many other things going on. But funnily enough, I spend some of my year in the north of Thailand,
yes,
and a bit in the south as well. And I just bought a little, or I built, I am building a little house in the jungle, and we have a durian farm. And durian is the very smelly fruit that's banned in lots of places because it smells of somebody passing wind, actually, is what it smells of. But it's very, very expensive and very popular with Chinese. We got 126 trees. And my girlfriend,
oh my God,
Pim, out there is a farmer, and so she's keen on farming it. So maybe I will become a farmer.
Moving on now, I mean, TV, I know you're not really a TV watcher. You watch YouTube now and again. If you go back in the last 3 or 4 years, I'm tipped off that you watch The Crown.
No, look, I mean, I don't know. I think maybe I was misleading you. I do turn the TV on and I veg out. And what I watch is sometimes, not very often, a few times a week. And it is complete relaxation. And I do watch YouTube and I watch a lot of history, Second World War history, all sorts of history. Yeah. I watch Sailing Le Vagabond, which is about this very attractive couple who've been sailing around the world for years. That sort of vicarious enjoyment. And I watch a lot of climbing things on YouTube. So sailing and climbing, I do a lot. Then, yes, I am boring. I watch The Crown and Clarkson's Farm and the big football matches and the big rugby matches. So, you know.
What did you like about The Crown? I mean, was there one period?
Well, it's this people that you know very well. And I grew up with all those people, you know, right through from a much, much younger Queen Elizabeth. I was born when her father was still king.
Yeah.
And a bit like sort of Bob Dylan has been there all the way through my life.
Yeah.
You know, sort of like the music of my life. And the royal family have as well. And, you know, I'm not an advocate for or against them, but they're something that's been a stable
constant
in my life. And it was very interesting to see that dramatization of it, it was all so straight up and true. Clarkson's Farm, I really didn't like Clarkson very much. And James May's a friend of mine.
Oh, right.
But Clarkson I was never keen on. And they only did Clarkson's Farm, and I completely changed my mind.
Really?
I thought he was absolutely great. Yeah, he was terrific.
Really?
So those are a couple of things I watched. Do you know, I'll tell you, the thing that I do think about television is that I really, really don't like violence.
Right.
On TV. I don't like violence. I don't like horror things. I don't like too scary things.
Yeah.
And I think somehow it seems to me that we, you know, as a race, not me actually, because I'm not, but, you know, a lot of people are inured to violence, and it becomes normal and interesting and killing and all of that.
Yes.
And I turn it off. So I start a lot of those series, the really intense ones, I start them off and I can see how great the acting is and all of that, but I don't want to watch that bad stuff. I do actually like watching The Sound of Music and some of those rock and roll films as well.
Yeah.
I like watching happy things.
But I mean, that's fair enough, isn't it? That's fair enough.
It may or may not be. It's just what I like.
But, it's not. This is about you. It's not about anything else.
There is some comfort in watching something that, you know, I've probably watched, my daughter liked Sound of Music, I've probably watched it a lot of times.
But that's the point, isn't it? It's the familiarity of it, and you're going, oh, this is a silly load of old rubbish, but I do like it, you know.
I liked ABBA when it was not fashionable to like ABBA.
Yeah, yes, got that. Why do you like ABBA? Why do you think ABBA were good? I mean, you worked in the music business, come on, so you must have...
Because it's just great dance music. It's great music to dance with too. It's very easy listening. I'm quite middle of the road, really. I like country music. Yeah, it's middle of the road music.
Have you seen Taylor Swift?
And I can appreciate the blues, and I love the blues, and I like all sorts of music. But it's something that I can sing along to, and I love to.
Can
sing.
I suggest the Sublime is Taylor Swift, and the Ridiculous is Spinal Tap. So, have you ever seen Taylor Swift?
Never. I wouldn't even recognise the song. She must be absolutely fantastic with her reputation, but I don't know her.
Yeah, no, okay. But it's quite funny, actually. She's just done six nights at Wembley Stadium.
Of course, yeah.
Which is huge, huge. What I liked that you referred to Spinal Tap, and I think for people who knew that, it was a mockumentary about a heavy metal band that a lot of people I knew were really taken in. They thought it was a genuine, they thought it was a real thing.
Yeah, I mean, if those of you don't know, it's a kind of spoof on a metal band. But, you know, I sometimes say I was in it, and I wasn't in Spinal Tap, but I was in the music business, and I was at rehearsals, and I went through all that stuff. And, you know, I met so many people who were just like the characters in Spinal Tap.
Recreating Stonehenge. It's great. But, I mean, I think we need to laugh, don't we? I mean, you know, that's some people are going watch Trading Places.
Yeah, I mean, laughter is great. I have to remind myself to laugh sometimes. And I do. I love to laugh. But I do have to remind myself to keep on smiling. Go out into the day, every day, with as big a smile on your face as possible.
Yes.
And I was very lucky. My father was a kind of larger than life. You know, he was a real sort of hail fellow, well met. You know, he'd talk to anybody, to my absolute embarrassment as a child. You know, I picked that up from him, and I can talk to anybody. I mean, I really can. People always say that, you know, I just meet people on the street and just strike up a conversation. Harder with girls in the day when I was younger, much yes. harder with women, because I wanted something. But, yeah. You know, with just generally with people, I can speak very easily to people.
Yeah, I would imagine that. Thing. Yes, I imagine you would be. Okay, so going on to books now, and this is, I imagine, quite an important book for you for all sorts of reasons. Joe Simpson's Touching the Void. Tell us something about that.
Joe's a friend of mine, and he wrote Touching the Void, which is about this expedition that he went on with a guy called Simon in the Andes, and they cut the rope, and he was an incredibly brave guy.
But
and
when you say cut the rope, you mean, I mean...
Touching the Void, I won't spoil the story for you, but they got into a situation where he broke both his legs very high up in the mountain, and his partner was lowering him down the mountain in the middle of the night, and they didn't have anything to tie themselves into. So he tied himself into you can make a snow pyramid, put the rope around, and the rope started slipping, was about to pull him over the edge. And he had to cut the rope because otherwise he'd have been pulled to his death. But there was a dilemma, and actually Joe fell 600 feet, and when, you know, how tenuous life is for all of us, and when he hit the bottom, which was a glacier,
yeah,
instead of, if he'd hit the solid glacier, he would have been dead, but he happened to hit a snow bridge over a crevasse that broke his fall.
Right.
And he fell 40 foot into a crevasse where he spent a day and a half, and eventually, with two broken legs, climbed out of it using two ice axes and his arms only. Incredible story. Of absolute obsession with living.
Gosh.
And, you know, when I used to read that, I read that book a lot of times, and, you know, I always wonder how I would behave in those situations, whether I would have the courage to do that. I think I might do, actually.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting thing, isn't it? The older you get, you've got more and more experience to draw on, and, yeah.
The desire to live, and I do now. I'm 72, and, you know, I want to live a long time. I actually, for many years, my objective was to live till I was 1,000 months old, which is 83 and a half. And my parents both died about 84 and 85. So that was for a long time. And now, in 2047, I will be 95. And that will be the 50th anniversary of the opening of Yo Sushi. And I would like to see that sitting in Yo Sushi. So right. My objective is now to do that, And then who knows what the objector would be after that. There is one in my mind, which was a guy I met in Miami who told me that his father, at the age of 104, had redecorated his apartment in Miami, and his neighbour got a bit drunk and asked him if he wasn't scared of dying at 104. And quick as a nit, this guy said, he said, very, very few people die at 104. Statistically, I'm safe as houses.
Great, that's good. Let me know which branch of Yosushi you're going to plan to be at, right?
Yeah, please come. Yeah, please, you're all invited.
Okay, moving on. Now, the big thing for you, I think, is climbing, right?
I've always been a climber and a sailor. I learnt to climb when I was at school at Marlborough 40 or 50 years ago, longer. And it's been a sort of thread that's gone through my entire life, whether it's been was in the early days rock climbing in North Wales,
right,
or mountaineering in Switzerland, and then with a friend of mine who's passed away now, Ian, we climbed all over the world, from South America and the Andes and Norway and all over. And so that's been a thread that's gone through my life. And my father taught me to sail when we were children.
Right, right.
And so I've always sailed, and I've had a few boats in my time for my sins. Always a dangerous thing to do, to have a boat. And I did sail across the Pacific. I did Panama to Fiji, which over a period of 2 years.
Blimey.
Including running my boat aground on the in the Tuamotos, which Captain Cook called the dangerous islands. Yeah.
Gosh.
That was quite a thing.
But with climbing, I mean, again, I'm trying to just orientate this. Is it something that is, do you find it very therapeutic? You maybe don't even think about that anymore because you've done it for so long.
I think anything that's very familiar, you know, it's a very, very intense thing, climbing, and you have to very much trust the person you're climbing with.
Yep.
Because, you know, your life is in their hands, literally. Exposure is an amazing thing, to have a big, big drop underneath you, but to trust the rope system.
Yes.
So I suppose there is a sort of metaphor there for mental health.
Yes.
To trust the rope system. And, you know, I do. I've done it for so long that I can be in a very exposed situation. You know, absolute certain chance of death if the rope broke. But I trust that system. I know it well. And sailing again, you know, to sail across the Pacific in the right season, both of them commune deeply with nature. And they mean that you take a real responsibility for yourself. But it's a very intense thing. And of course, the other thing with climbing is that when you do get to the top of a pitch or a mountain or whatever, the sense of relief that you've got there is very good.
A mixture.
And also, yeah, and also that, you know, going back, so relating it back to mental health, it's such an intense thing that you can't think about anything else.
Yeah.
So it is almost a meditation in that sense. You know, the thing with meditation I've always found is that, well, I've always found it quite difficult meditation, although I do, but a dangerous sport like that, something very intense, even at the local climbing wall, your brain is so engaged in what you're doing, that voice in the back of your head that's the monkey that's in there can't go on. And in difficult times, I think I have been climbing and found a familiar place.
I imagine that when people, you know, when people are really a bit fed up, super fed up, and everything's going wrong in their lives, one of the great things is to be disconnected from that, and just, you know, I mean, I remember I used to temp in bowling. You needed to focus all the time. You weren't thinking about yourself and your probs. But what I really loved that you said, you know, when we did the original episode, you talked about this idea of a thank God hold, and I think it's brilliant.
I think it's quite sort of, you know, old fashioned climbing term. I don't know if I have them anymore. But when you're really stretched on a climb and you've got a few moves to go, maybe sort of 10 feet to move up, and you're right on the edge, you know, very, very thin holds, and trying to keep your breathing together and not get scared, because that's when you're you know, your control of your mind, I suppose.
Yeah.
And often when you're in that position and you feel you can't go on, that if you do go on and you make another move or two, you come to a big hole for your hand. We used to call them thank God holes because it was like, oh, what a relief. You know?
Okay. All right. Well, that's great. What's the story with you and pets? Any story or no story?
I had two pets when I was a child, Cinders and Bramble. One of the names of the wirehead dachshunds we had.
Oh, really?
And funny enough, you know, over the years, I've done quite a lot of, you know, these personal development courses. And I went on one when everybody sort of gave feedback to you about what they thought would be good for your life.
Yeah.
And several people said you should get a dog, Simon.
Yeah.
You know, somebody, you know, so really, perhaps because I found it difficult to sort of take down the barriers that prevent me from really loving and being loved.
Yeah.
And that's taken a long time. And a dog's love is a very easy, much easier thing. So perhaps in our place in the jungle in Thailand, I might get a I've got in mind that I'd like to have a dog.
I think that's great. I think you have a dog.
Outlast me.
You have a dog vibe about you, Simon. So I think that would be really, really good. Okay, so.
And also, I've ridden horses a lot. And
oh, yeah, right.
And that's a relationship. I mean, that's a different relationship because they're not so sort of cuddly, petty horse. But there is very definitely an understanding. And a horse, people don't understand that, but a horse really needs a master. A good rider really is in charge of the horse.
Yeah.
It's not a joint thing. They're really in charge of the horse. An intelligent horse, of course, that does good. But they want to know that you know where you're going.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you feel safe, they feel safe.
Yes.
Yeah, I like to be controlled in a sense, which, you know, I've always been quite good at controlling people to my detriment. I've learned in my life. But with horses, you know, it's a very old-fashioned thing to say. And I find myself saying more things like that. But even in relationships, in my relationship with a Thai woman of a respectable age, I might add.
Yes.
She really wants to be looked after.
Yes.
And she wants me to make the decisions. And it's an old-fashioned relationship. And actually, it works very well for me. You know, I make decisions in her best interest and she wants to look after me. And it's pretty nice.
That's great.
I've had difficulties with, you know, real equal relationships in that sense. It works.
Great. That sounds pretty good. I like it. So moving on, now we get to the music side. And music's quite interesting, isn't it? If you've worked in the music business, sometimes people are addicted to music. And sometimes quite the opposite. But you've got lots of...
I was the opposite. I worked in the concert business, actually, putting on live shows.
Yeah.
And because, especially in the early days, there were so many problems and so many things that went wrong and it was so stressful.
Yeah.
That I got really, I sort of, you know, music just became a business for me and I no longer enjoyed the pleasure of it. It just reminded me of difficult times. Until the Walkman came along, which is this like sort of portable cassette player in those days. And I put on a pair of headphones for the first time. Suddenly my interest, you know, just like listening to music through headphones the first time you hear it, it's mind-blowing.
It came back.
It was in those days especially. And it came back to me.
I know you worked with George Michael. What did you think of him? I mean, as, you know, an act and as a person.
George Michael I knew as a very young man, him and Andrew. A bit. I wouldn't say I was particularly good friends with them, but I did a couple of big shows for them and we worked with them and they were just two kids having a great time. And actually sort of looking up to people like me because we were a bit older. They were sort of excited to have we built a big stage set for them, so they were excited to take a big live show out, but they'd never done it before.
Right.
But you know, a lot of those guys, I mean, they're fantastic performer. I never knew him, but I did know that he went through a lot of, I knew his doctor at one point.
Yes.
Through a lot of difficult times. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that was a great shame. Ian Dury. Now it's said that you can recite some Ian Dury. Is that true?
Well, Ian Dury was, you know, a bit like, in some ways, like Paul McCartney, who was bought, you know, he wrote a lot of the stuff McCartney wrote was kind of almost music hall, you know, Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club, you know, real music hall. And Ian Dury, in the same way, was music hall. And interesting, it was just for the it's a UK audience. He was big, but when he died, I remember thinking, you know, well, how sad that was. But also, I remember thinking, it can't be that hard to write one of those rhyming songs. And another thing is, he can't sing either, because I could never sing in tune. And I actually did write a song called "How I Got My Yo." My name is Simon, not a lot of people know. And I sent them off to Chaz Jankel, who was the keyboard player in the Blockheads. And he called me up, and a long story, but he called me up one day and said, I've written the song, you know. He said, I didn't know, I still had it in me after Ian's gone. And he played it to me over the phone. And I remember saying, I said, it sounds just like the Blockheads. He said, well, it would do, wouldn't it? I just wrote it. And 3 months later, just from the seed of doing that, writing lyrics, sending them to Chaz, who I didn't know at the time, I ended up 3 months later in the studio, in Eastcote Studios, where Ian Dury and the Blockheads had made New Boots and Panties and all those records. And I was the lead singer of my favourite band, and we made 8 tracks.
Really?
We've got machines now; you can put you back in tune.
Oh yeah.
And then I used to do a lot of speaking at conferences and things post Dragon's Den. And I used to, my party trick really was that at the end I used to tell the story that I just told you, which is a motivational story. If you sow a seed, something can happen. And I'd put the backing track on and I'd go out and sing it live. And as Chaz Jankel always said, he said, you just give it some welly, Simon, belt it out. Nobody will ever know you're not in tune. And people used to come up to me and said, you were a great singer. And I'd just go,
thanks.
Yeah. Well, I knew I wasn't. I'm not a good singer. But if you give it enough welly and with enough character, you can get away with anything. So Dare to dream.
Well, but I think that's very interesting, you know, having listened back to your episode quite a few times now, and it stands out as a theme, really, you know, all the, you know, feel the fear and do it anyway, get out of your comfort zone. But you have got this thing where, I know, I'm going to ring up Harvey Goldsmith, where you think, you know, just try these things, do it. It's interesting.
Your emotions can be boiled down to 4 emotions, really. So was it mad, which is sort of sad, glad, mad, sad, glad, and fearful.
Right.
Anger, sadness, happiness, and fear. And a lot of our time on this planet is spent with a fair amount of fear for an awful lot of people.
Yep.
I think that to confront that fear, to that expression I like, which is follow your fear to find your destiny, and to celebrate it. And I think, you know, fear of financial insecurity will leave you if you have the boldness and the courage to go out and confront it and see it run off into the distance. Amazing, really.
Yeah, courage is a thing, isn't it, really? And also just being prepared to try something and not just go, oh,
well, you will only live once on this earth. Unless you go out and try things, you're a very lucky man. All of us were lucky people.
Yeah.
Men and women. You know, we won that race, that first event of our life. We won that race to win a life. So it's worth wearing it lightly and having a go at things and just confronting that fear, knowing that it is just a feeling, and that if you step outside that comfort zone for long enough, the feeling subsides and your comfort zone gets bigger.
Absolutely. Okay. No, it's great. I mean, I think this is inspirational stuff, and we're real. Chose 2 poems. How to Get Rich by Felix Dennis. Stop the Clocks, W.H. Auden. So which has inspired you, helped you the most?
I don't know. I mean, I always tell people that business is pretty simple, and Rich and Felix Dennis, who's a publisher,
yeah,
and drank a lot and did all sorts of awful things like that, but actually eventually gave everything up and started writing poetry. And he wrote this great poem called
Rich.
It's actually a book he wrote as well, which goes, ideas we've had 'em since Eve first met Adam, but take it from me, execution's the key. Good fortune, the truth is, the harder you work, the more that you sweat, the luckier you get. The money, go find a likely investor, meaning people like me, to get what you need, you toadies to greed. And then I'll shorten it, but it finishes up. The first step, just do it and bluff your way through it. Remember to duck. Godspeed and good luck.
Great. I'd forgotten that.
And W.H. Auden, that's a beautiful poem. Obviously, Rudyard Kipling, If, is a very inspirational poem. If you can keep your head when all around you are losing theirs and blaming it on others. If you can walk with kings, yet keep the common touch.
Yes.
If you can build a heap of all your winnings and risk it on one turn of pitch and toss and lose and start again at the beginning and never breathe a word about your loss. All that sort of stuff. I've always loved, you know, wear life lightly.
Well, we're coming to the end now. You've got one thing which I think is quite interesting, which you refer to as an insight timer, which is an app. Now, that's connected to meditation, is it not?
Well, you know, there's always ones. My friend's Alex Tu did Calm. But, you know, that's very much about sort of guided meditations and all of that. And I tried all that. It doesn't really work for me. But no, I just, the Insight Timer is just literally a timing machine. I think it does have some extra bits, but it just gives you a nice gong at the beginning and every 10 minutes. And I do, at home in Thailand especially, we do 50 minutes every morning pretty much. And the last 10 minutes of meditation, the first 40 minutes of my version of exercise and yoga, or sort of freestyle.
Right, okay.
It just it gives you a really nice Indian gong every 10 minutes. And you're thinking, oh, that's another one gone. They're getting closer to the meditation. And then we get through the meditation and you're done. You get on with the day.
Well, we'll make a note of that. That's quite interesting, actually. It's a very practical thing to have, a timer, isn't it? Now, all those years ago, I asked you, there's two things I'm going to say, and we always say it at the end of Life Jackets, that the Scottish doctor, who was called Dr. McTavish, in 1879 was asked, what do you need to be happy? And he said, oh, that's very straightforward, you need three things: something to do, someone or something to love, and something to hope for. Would you add, take away, disagree, or what?
Funny enough, that is, believe it or not, I didn't know that that was the person who said it, but my daughter, Charlotte, has always said that, that exact thing. And she always says, look, I've got something to do. She's an interior designer, and she's got a website that sells all sorts of things for houses. She said, I've got something to do. I've got someone to love. She's got a good husband and two children, and she's got something to hope for. She's always up to doing something new. And I've taken that on board very much. I think they're two beautiful things. So what is mine then? I've got something to do every day of my life. I wouldn't say I work very hard, but I've still got interests in things. I've got Nick who manages things. And, you know, I keep going. In Japan, they don't have a word for good luck, but their equivalent word is keep going. Which I always like. So I got something to do. And I got to still do sports and all of that. I've got someone to love. I've got my daughter, my grandchildren, and importantly, my girlfriend in Thailand. I've got lots to hope for, not least of which is to live a very long life. I mean, call me selfish, but all those people who say, oh, I don't want to be old and be in a wheelchair, and somehow or other, I'm in that period of your life which you could call Sniper's Alley. Anything could come along and get you, and so far I've got away with everything. So I've got a slight suspicion that I'm blessed in this area, and I do try and eat well, and I do take a lot of exercise. I do exercise every single day. I get a sweat up every day. So
well, that's interesting.
Yeah, I'm fortunate, and I do love those three things. Beautiful.
Well, okay, so this is the final one, okay? And okay. And maybe you've answered it already. Let's imagine that a young man aged 19, 20, very similar to you back then when you were, who's perhaps not feeling that great about life or himself, knocked on your door and asked for directions. What would you say? What would you think?
Well, I mean, I was that young man. I was a very lost young man in my late teens, early 20s. I was really lost. And in terms of, you know, how to forge a life, I would say it doesn't really matter what you do. What matters is you go out and do anything.
Do something.
And when I was sailing across the Pacific, I remember talking to somebody's kid. They wanted me to go and talk to them, and he was just really lost and smoked dope every day and all of that stuff. And he said, well, I just don't know what to do. I said, I'll tell you what you should do. In fact, I'm going to give you an instruction. You do it for the next week, 7 days, and then you tell me how you got on. I said, go out into your street where there's all that rubbish along the wall, take the plastic bags and pick up, you know, the rubbish and put it in the plastic bag and try and fill up 10 bags or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And he did it for a week, and everybody came up to him and said, what you're doing, on the first day, on the second day, and the third day, they said, what you're doing is an amazing thing. And at the end of the 7 days, he had a sort of little shred of self-esteem.
Yeah.
And he went off on to get a job and to do all sorts of things. And do anything, over-deliver in whatever you do, and smile a lot and have enthusiasm about whatever you do. And then, you know, opportunities come along and you just got to put your head above the parapet and say yes and try new things. If you sit at home worrying about what you're going to do and I don't know what to do and all of that, you won't get anywhere. Even if you just go and pick up the rubbish on your street.
No, I think that's great. And I think, you know, what you say about establishing self-esteem, because that seems to me to be such a driver, you know, poor self-esteem, low self-esteem, such a driver for poor mental health, basically, and inertia. And I think what you're saying is, that's it, action.
Yeah, it is action, but it's action always sounds terrifying because, you know, you've got to go and do something very difficult.
Yeah.
But just doing a tiny, tiny little bit at a time, but doing anything. And it's practice. You just practice, 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 and you get better at anything.
Yeah, building sort of mental muscles.
Yeah, that's right.
Brilliant. Simon, we have come to the end of this now, and that's been very interesting. Really good fun. I knew it would be, and I thank you for being such a generous soul. I look forward to seeing you in Yo Sushi in, when you're 95, and I'm very...
2047.
Okay, well, that's very, very, that's very near now.
February the 14th, actually. Valentine's Day is my birthday.
Oh, right, is it? Oh, well, my birthday's 3 days Sushi. Before, so...
Okay, well, there you go. Well, you can celebrate yours, and Yo Sushi is 50 years old on January the 27th.
Anyway, listen, tip top and tidy. Onwards and upwards, and we will speak anon.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Simon. See you later. Appreciate it. You're a good guy.